Welcome to Practical Perspectives on the Management of Patients with Desmoid Tumors, part one of a two-part podcast series. This is a medical oncologist, Dr. Neil Love. I met with Professor Bernd Kasper from the University of Heidelberg, Mannheim Cancer Center, Mannheim, Germany, who in this initial program discusses several key publications and presentations in a mini journal club format. And then in part two, Professor Kasper discusses several real-world cases presented by medical oncologists working in this field. We begin our journal club with an article in JAMA Oncology, for which Professor Kasper was first author, from the Desmoid Tumor Working Group, providing an update on a series of critical management algorithms of the disease. The paper describes the recent FDA approval of nirogacestat, an orally available reversible gamma secretase inhibitor, which was compared in an international phase 3 placebo-controlled randomized double-blind controlled trial comparing it to placebo in adult patients with progressing desmoid tumors. The trial randomized 142 patients and demonstrated a significant improvement in PFS with a hazard ratio of 0.29, which was statistically and clinically significant, and in improvements in secondary patient-reported outcomes. Adverse events with nirogacestat included diarrhea, nausea, fatigue, hypophosphatemia, and maculopapular rash, with 95% of all treatment-emergent adverse events grade 1 or 2. Among females with reproductive potential receiving nirogacestat, 27 of 36 had ovarian toxic effects. The DeFi trial represents the largest and most rigorous randomized clinical trial conducted to date in desmoid tumors. The paper concludes that, quote, given its safety profile, nirogacestat may well become the first-line treatment for desmoid tumors when an active medical treatment is indicated. I asked Professor Kasper to comment on the key points of this paper.
That's actually an initiative which already dates back 10 years ago. And we started that in 2014, put together a group of medical experts, also together with patients and patient advocates, and tried to set up treatment guidelines and harmonize this treatment strategies for this disease. This JAMA publication is the latest update of these guidelines from what we call the Desmoid Tumor Working Group. What is very important, and that's actually something that has changed dramatically over the last 10, 20 years, is that active surveillance is the frontline approach for the majority of the patients with a newly diagnosed desmoid tumor. And the idea behind that is actually just to find out who of the patients really show a progressing desmoid tumor, which is in need for treatment. And because there are around 50% of the desmoids don't need any treatment, they are just stable, or we even see spontaneous regressions in up to 20-25%.
And can you talk a little bit about some of the specific clinical scenarios that you went through in the paper, beginning with abdominal wall desmoids? Why are these different than those in other locations? And can you talk a little bit about this algorithm you put together?
Yeah, we actually put together algorithms for the different localizations where these desmoid tumors can occur. And one example where they are also quite often is the abdominal wall. Just to remind you, that's a disease in a young patient population, 30 to 35 years. We have a 2/3 female predominance, and the abdominal wall localization is quite common. And that's the paradigm shift over the last 15, 20 years, is that surgery is not the primary treatment strategy anymore. And we tend to treat these patients now more and more with medical therapy or with systemic therapies. But we will come to that, I think, later. But the abdominal wall desmoid actually is one of the very rare locations where we still consider surgery, where surgery is an option in first line or when there is need for an active treatment. But then we also have, of course, the medical therapy and the local ablative techniques such as cryoablation, for example.
So can you maybe contrast a little bit about what you said in terms of abdominal wall with what you also, the algorithm you have for mesenteric tumors, non-FAP?
Yeah, for mesenteric non-FAP desmoid tumors, medical therapy is usually the first line treatment when there is an indication for treatment, which means when there is a progressing desmoid tumor. But surgery can still be an option, but you always have to keep in mind that the morbidity is low, or you use surgery when treating complications. And this is actually even a more important when we go to FAP-associated desmoid tumors, which actually typically occur in the retroperitoneal, pelvic, or mesenteric region. And there, surgery is only indicated to treat the complication. There might be complications such as bleeding, obstruction, perforation, and these complications should be treated with surgery. But then the aim is not to completely resect the desmoid tumor. It's more to treat the complication, and medical therapy remains the first-line treatment for these patients.
In terms of intervention and in general, what are some of the major differences between FAP and non-FAP situations?
So in principle, actually, the guidelines are quite similar for FAP-associated desmoids and sporadic desmoids. Maybe just to put that into a perspective, I think it's important to mention that the majority are sporadic desmoid tumors, 90 to 95%. And we have only between 5 to 10% of desmoid tumors are associated with FAP. And actually, what we learned from clinical practice is that obviously the FAP-associated desmoid tumors seem to be more aggressive, a bit more difficult to treat. And due to the localization where they are, which is exactly this localization we are talking about here, they can actually lead to complications. And a desmoid is usually not a life-threatening disease, but these are situations which can actually lead to a life-threatening situation.
So another great algorithm slide focuses on desmoid in the extremities or girdles of the chest wall.
Yeah, for the extremity localization or chest wall localization, surgery doesn't play any role anymore as a primary treatment option. Medical therapy is the first line treatment, and or alternatively, you can think of local ablative techniques, and cryoablation is one example here, or isolated limb perfusion is another example which might be used here.
And finally, another algorithm looking at intrathoracic or head and neck tumors.
Yeah, the head and neck desmoid tumors are always quite difficult to treat because of their localizations. There are a lot of nerves, vessels, and this makes everything difficult. And here you can see that we even put medical therapy as the only treatment option in first line, and this is actually the way to go. Surgery or also local ablative techniques do not play any role here in first line treatment.
So let's move on now. We'll talk about a couple other papers. We did a recent program with Dr. Rattan where we talked about this Journal of Clinical Oncology paper looking at long-term nirogacestat treatment in patients who were in the DeFi trial. And then you presented at the ESMO Sarcoma and Rare Cancer Congress a paper, again, looking at long-term treatment or follow-up of these patients. Can you talk a little bit about what we've learned? I guess these were people who actually were on the original study who ended up getting treated for long periods of time.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. So this is, I mean, these are more or less both the same publications. One was an oral presentation in Lugano last year, and the other one from Ravin Rattan as first author is the full publication. And just to remind you, I mean, DeFi has been the pivotal trial, the randomized phase 3 trial leading to approval of this compound of nirogacestat and for desmoid tumors. And what we looked here in this open label extension analysis is actually that patients after unblinding had the chance to continue treatment with nirogacestat, and then they were treated for up to 3-4 years. And we looked at these long-term results here, and the overall response rate increased from 34% That was in the primary analysis for up to 1 year treatment duration, and that increased to 46% for those patients who were on nirogacestat for up to 4 years. So obviously, when you continue treatment, there are more responses. In terms of safety, there were not any major differences regarding the most frequent adverse events: diarrhea, nausea, fatigue, hypophosphatemia, rash, and ovarian toxicity were actually the most frequent side effects. What was quite interesting to see is that the incidence and severity of these frequently reported adverse events decreased after year one. That was quite interesting to see in this long-term analysis.
Yeah, it seems like you see that a lot with oral agents in oncology, that the longer patients are on, the better they seem to tolerate it. You know, I guess these patients, it's very interesting that you're able to follow them for long periods. I guess they were getting a treatment they wouldn't be able to get outside of the trial, so I can understand why they'd want to continue in treatment. But I'm just kind of curious how these data sync up with a very common question that you'll hear a lot in these cases we're going to present, which is how long do you treat? Yeah. And particularly here now, you see greater responses. So right now, how do you approach? We were talking about the consensus approach. I'm curious what the recommendation is. And is there a consensus about how long to treat? I'm sure you have to factor in whether they're continuing to respond or tolerating it, but what's the current approach?
Yeah, that's a difficult question, Bob. That's a question which is very much discussed always, and I always get this question because we do not really have very good data for that. The consensus from the group, from the desmoid tumor working group, was actually to treat patients, and this is not specifically for gamma secretase inhibitors, this is for all systemic therapies, at least 6 to 12 months before really evaluating effectiveness of the treatment. What we can maybe say here is that we have a quite nice study for sorafenib. Sorafenib is a TKI which we also used and still use in for desmoid tumor patients. And there, our Indian colleagues performed a study which is called SORA Stop, and they stopped sorafenib exactly after 1 year, and then could show that the progression-free survival after another year was 90%, and after 3 years was even 80%. So obviously, with sorafenib, it's quite safe to stop treatment after 1 year. If this is the same with the gamma secretase inhibitors, to be honest, we don't really know. But what I can at least say, I mean, presenting this long-term data doesn't necessarily mean that we have to treat the patients for that long. So maybe 1 year is enough, but to be honest, I cannot fully answer that question. But that's actually our recommendation in the paper, to treat the patients at least 6 to 12 months.
What was the actual stipulated duration in the DeFi trial? Did you define a duration, or you kind of left it up to the
treating doc? DeFi, that's exactly the point. DeFi was not designed to define a treatment duration. So patients could be treated in that trial until disease progression or until intolerance. And I mean, you have to remember, by that time, there was nothing else available. So the problem was, when the patients stopped treatment, they went off study. And when the desmoid tumor recurs, there was nothing else except the conventional therapies we have to give them again. So they were not able to go again on the study and start again with nirogacestat. That was a bit the problem. So you can imagine that patients continue treatment and wanted to stay on the trial.
So kind of a related question, and again, I heard a couple of cases where this came up, is do you see delayed response initially? Do you see people who get, for example, who get nirogacestat and really don't respond for 3, 4, 5 months, and then they respond? And what's the typical time to response?
Yeah, I mean, the typical time to objective response in the study was 5.6 months, which is typical. But you always have to differentiate it between, on the one hand, the clinical response, which is pretty fast. So clinically, these patients describe, say, pain reduction, improvement in functional or physical enroll and physical functioning. And this is very quick, within days or a few weeks. But of course, the radiological response is much later. And there, the median time is 5.6 months. But yes, we sometimes do see late responses as well. As you can see in the long-term results, there were also responses after 2 or 3 years even.
So one final question. I don't know, there's another example. I mentioned our target audience, the general oncologist. So we are, you know, in all parts of oncology. I don't think there's another situation or another trial in oncology where you see a more dramatic example of patient-reported outcomes than the DeFi study, particularly because it was placebo-controlled. I mean, that is just amazing to me. And of course, in this long-term data, we saw that these treatment benefits tended to continue. And, you know, it really is amazing to me that this could be things like fatigue, et cetera. You could actually see a difference there. I'm just kind of curious, clinically, you mentioned that a lot of times you see people starting to sort of feel better. But what do you typically see? What kinds of parameters improve from a quality? I mean, pain we can understand, but what other types of parameters do you see improving?
Yeah, I mean, you can, of course, you can see pain reduction. You can see that if there is an impairment in moving, that was better. Usually there is a better enroll of physical functioning. And you are exactly right. I mean, what was really something special about DeFi was the number of patient-reported outcomes we captured here. And what was so interesting that the results were so consistent in favor of nirogacestat, despite the different tools we used. I mean, we used tool for pain, that was the brief pain inventory short form. We used a specific score, which is called the Goddess score, which has been specifically developed for desmoid tumor patients. But we also used this old traditional ERTC QLQC30 score, and we saw very consistent results showing a benefit for nirogacestat with all these different items and tools.
Yeah, I kind of wondered whether if you hadn't actually seen changes in the tumors, you know, to justify approval, whether you might have actually seen your approval just based on the patient-reported outcomes. It is so strong and the data is so consistent. But fortunately, you also saw the tumors shrink, so we didn't need to worry about that. But it really is impressive.
Exactly. Yeah.
So another topic that, of course, is really a critical here in patients getting nirogacestat, I guess, is a somewhat unexpected impact in terms of ovarian function that's been seen. And I know you have, I love these trials in progress papers. And there was this one on, I think it's your study, actually, looking at premenopausal women being treated with nirogacestat. So can you talk a little bit about what we know in terms of the impact right now in premenopausal women and what you're going to look at in this study?
Yeah. When we look again at the results from DeFi, from the primary trial, is that, yes, obviously this ovarian toxicity is an issue with this drug and is something which is quite common here. So if you look at the young women with childbearing potential, we see these symptoms in 70-75% of the patients. But on the other hand, what we also learned in the trial is that this is something which is obviously resolving in the majority of the patients. So we saw that if the patients stop the drug, then we have a resolution rate of 100%. And even if they continue the drug, the resolution rate is something like 2/3, I think. So, but yes, I mean, it's definitely something you have to discuss with your patients. And a requirement actually from the FDA was to look a bit closer at this issue. And that's the reason why we set up that phase 4 trial to further characterize the incidence and the recovery rate of the ovarian toxicity in these females of reproductive potential. It's a rather small study, only in females between 18 and 40 years old. They are treated for up to 24 cycles, which means 2 years. By the way, this is quite interesting here because in this trial, the treatment duration is limited for a maximum of 2 years. And the target here or the aim is here to enroll approximately 50 eligible patients, so that at the end we have a number of 40 patients who are treated with Nyro for 1 year, for at least 1 year. That's the target.
So I'm curious, any other sort of clinical issues that come up in these patients? What do you do if a patient doesn't recover ovarian function? How do you think through patients who wish to have children in the future? Any evidence that it'll impact fertility?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's definitely something you should discuss with your patients beforehand. There is also, if patients are extremely anxious, and what you can do, you can, of course, do a cryoconservation of eggs. That's something which you can, of course, offer your patients. But usually, I believe that's not actually necessary, but it definitely looks like this is an on-off phenomenon with a drug, and it's obviously something which we specifically see in this class of drugs of these gamma secretase inhibitors. But by the way, not only in these gamma secretase inhibitors, is something which we are faced with in oncology quite often. We also see this with tyrosine kinase inhibitors and with chemo, of course. But yes, it's something to discuss with your patients, to mention to your patients. But I think, on the other hand, we should not overemphasize that.
So just a couple of related questions. What do we know about the mechanisms of what's going on here? What do we see in terms of hormonal profiles? You see elevated gonadotropins. What do we know about why this is going on?
This is a good question. I think this is also a question which we come back when we look at the cases. And there has always been an hypothesis or discussions about if there is a correlation between desmoid tumor growth and estrogens and the female hormonal status. But to be honest, this could never formally been proven that this is the case. And this is also the reason, by the way, why we are not proposing anti-hormonal therapies anymore in our guidelines. And we are doing this now for many years. So anti-hormonal therapies are not part of the armamentarium for these patients anymore.
This concludes part one of our program. Special thanks to Professor Casper, and thank you for tuning in. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes, and please note that the use of agents and treatments that are not approved may have been discussed in the program, so check out the package inserts for more. This is Dr. Neil Love for Practical Perspectives on the Management of Desmoid Tumors.